Good morning, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm John Sloop, along with co-hosts Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty. And we're grateful that you have tuned in today as we continue our conversation on the important issue of the sanctity of life. You know, the Bible is quite clear that life begins at conception in the mother's womb. Just listen to God's word to the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 1. The word of the Lord came to me saying, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations." It doesn't get any clearer that God knows us and he has a plan and purpose for every life beginning in the mother's womb. And then these verses from perhaps one of my favorite psalms, Psalm 139. The psalmist says, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God." So there may be a debate in the public square about when life begins, but the Word of God is certain on that fact. Now, on last week's program, which I was able to listen to online, and by the way, friends, it is so easy to do. Just go to the valleyfamilyforum.org website, scroll down to the banner that says Crossroads Online, and look through all the past programs by date and subject. You never have to miss a program. And you guys were so informative last week as you talked about the social, cultural, and spiritual aspects of the abortion issue.
High five, Dean.
High fives.
We try, Doc. We do our best.
I was impressed, and I learned a lot. Now, today, we will continue to discuss the legal and legislative aspects of the abortion debate surrounding this critical public policy issue. Now, Rita, get ready, for in a moment, as our legal scholar, I'm going to ask you to outline Roe v. Wade in layman's terms so that even Dean and I can understand it, as well as our listeners, so that we can grasp the essence of the law. But first, Dean, you are our senior citizen on the panel.
Thank you.
You were around when Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973.
Still in diapers, but I was around.
And actually, our beloved Rita was not even born.
That's right.
She was simply a twinkle in her father's eye.
Let no one forget.
And regrettably, I was in my senior year of seminary at a liberal seminary where Roe v. Wade was actually celebrated.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, Dean, from your perspective, share with us, what was the impact on the nation in 1973 when Roe v. Wade was passed?
John, I can't speak for the nation. I can speak for me personally. And frankly, the date, for our listeners who don't even know anything about Roe v. Wade, and I know maybe half of our listeners have never heard this phrase, have never heard a reference, because I talked to somebody just this past week, didn't know about it. The date was January 22nd, 1973. I was a diplomat in training at the State Department in Washington at that time, just a couple of miles from the Supreme Court building. But John, I don't recall even hearing or reading about the decision at that time. I was just getting used to having a new baby, starting a new career. As far as I was concerned, it never happened. Yep. And it didn't register for another 30 years,
wow.
John. I paid no attention to Roe v. Wade or to what was happening to life in America.
That was your Rip Van Winkle years.
When we came back to the Valley, I had that Rip Van Winkle epiphany that we've talked about, where I held my first grandson in my hands, and the reality of life really took hold. Last week, Rita mentioned Randy Alcorn's book, Why Pro-Life. Just had a profound influence on me to learn about the importance of the sanctity of life. That's when it all began, and we've been trying to make up ground ever since. So I'm just delighted to have this opportunity to talk about Roe v. Wade.
Thank you, Dean. Rita, again, help us understand Roe v. Wade. What really was at issue and what did it mean?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked. I think it is an important thing to talk about because I bet, Dean, even people who are familiar with the name Roe versus Wade and who understand vaguely what its impact has been maybe have never actually read the Supreme Court opinion or understood how the Supreme Court arrived at the decision it did. And I think it's really important to understand that. In this case, a woman referred to as Jane Roe challenged a Texas statute prohibiting abortion. This was a state law, was not a federal law. Jane Roe argued that this Texas law prohibiting abortion violated what she called her right to privacy. Now, where is right to privacy mentioned in the Constitution, Dean? Do you recall seeing it anywhere in there?
I would just take a wild guess. I'll pick a number, maybe the 14th Amendment.
Well, but even the right to privacy is not actually a right that the Constitution discusses.
Right.
The court has said that the right to privacy emanates from other provisions that are in the Constitution.
Right.
Now, the state of Texas argued that it had an interest in protecting the life of the unborn child. This was why it had this law prohibiting abortion. The state said that the unborn child had a right to life protected by the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment, which you alluded to, provides that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, in this case, the Supreme Court explicitly recognized that it was this question of personhood. Was the unborn child a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment? That was the central issue of the case. And as we know now, the court ended up rejecting the argument that the unborn baby qualified as a person.
You know, that is incredible, Rita, that they got so confused. This was a life. Oh, so when does the life become a person? You get into that marsh and that swampland of semantics, linguistics, and language, and they went far astray. But I don't understand how they could have rejected that whole idea that this was a person. It was a life. So did they go to science to try to figure that out?
No. Amazingly, they did not go to science. They said, you know, they were not going to get into the scientific debate, as they called it. What they did was look at legal history, the history of the law, and determine that because unborn babies had not consistently been treated as persons for legal purposes, the court could not conclude that the term person in the Constitution was intended to include children in the womb.
Rita, if I remember correctly, one of the points the court raised was that even the state of Texas, which now claimed that the unborn baby had a right to life, had not consistently treated the baby as a person because it permitted abortion in certain circumstances. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, let that be a lesson to us. We all are residents of states, and the legislative process that is happening in our state houses, wherever we live, matters. And this is one of the implications of the fact that that state's law and the laws of other states were not consistent in this regard, in treating the unborn child as a person with human dignity.
In all circumstances, right. Not just a selected, isolated few. And I'm glad you mentioned other states, because it wasn't only Texas that had these laws prohibiting or at least limiting abortion. Nearly every state in the union had laws at that time pertaining to abortion and the sanctity of life. Okay, so we know that the court ended up with this terrible decision that broke the pregnancy into trimesters. Why did it do that? What was the purpose of that?
You know, it really invented that concept of trimesters of pregnancy, seemingly out of thin air.
Rather than a continuum of life, it broke it into three chapters.
Right. So once the court decided that the baby was not a person under the Constitution, the baby had no source of legal rights at all. So the court was left then to balance this mother's right of privacy against the state's interest in protecting what the court called potential life. And the way the court did that was to say that in the first trimester, the state could not restrict the right of abortion at all. In the second trimester, it could restrict abortion somewhat, and in the third trimester and after viability, the state could prohibit abortion except where the woman's life or health was in danger.
Yeah. And I just want to note here that the court took the issue out of the political process at this point by, we might say, constitutionalizing a very specific right. That, by the way, is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution and never envisioned by its drafters.
And, John, that's why this gets so complicated. Rita, you've used three words here that just appear to be the root of the problem. The first one is person. What on earth is a person? How do you define that? It's so ambiguous. And then the second word is potential. Potential life? I don't understand. What on earth is that? When does a life at conception become more than just a potential life? It's a life or it's not a life. There's nothing in between. The third word is viability, but let's get to that later. You've got three challenges coming on here. So another court decision, though, that followed on this was in, I think it was 1992. It was a Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision that tried to clarify some of the Roe v. Wade court decision. Yeah. How did that go?
And, you know, I have to mention that among legal scholars, no matter what their political persuasion is or their thoughts on abortion itself as an issue, there is broad consensus that the Roe versus Wade decision is just a disaster in terms of, you know, the legal reasoning and the justification. It's legally a disastrous decision. So in this next landmark case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court is trying to sort of salvage what has happened already.
The wreckage.
Yeah, exactly. So in Casey, the Supreme Court affirmed the basic holding of Roe versus Wade, but it did away with that trimester framework, and instead it set this concept of viability, your favorite word, Dean.
I'm tearing out my hair.
As the primary factor in determining when state laws restricting abortions would be permissible. So go ahead, tell us why you don't like viability.
I hate the term because, like the other two I mentioned earlier, person and potential life, it is so ambiguous. The pro-abortion crowd seems to think that until the little baby can live and eat on its own, independent of its mother, then it's not viable. Yeah. That gives the abortionist the right to tear it out of the mother's womb and throw it into the trash. Really? And as we said last week, it is viable from the point of conception if you just let the little bugger alone in the womb until he or she decides it's time to get out.
Yeah, you know, and I have to say about that too, it really is a disturbing concept that the only way this living human being can have protected legal rights is for it to be somehow independent. The idea of viability outside the womb is really about independence. So I'm thinking of all the living human beings in hospital rooms around the country. Are we willing to say they have no protectable legal rights
because they are not independent? That's the slippery slope.
And I'm thinking of my mother and other older people, our parents who are going into Alzheimer's. Are they not persons? Are they not viable? You're exactly right. That's the danger.
You know, one of the things that really, really disturbs me about this whole discussion is the phrase that is so often used, and it's used by people on both sides of the aisle. They say, well, but this is settled law.
Oh, yes.
I say, you know, if it's settled, our goal is to unsettle it.
That's right.
I believe that we absolutely need to work and have a goal to reverse Roe versus Wade and other decisions.
John, on that point, Dred Scott was settled law, too, in 1857.
Absolutely. Yes. And, you know, when the people speak, laws can be changed. Yes. There are other decisions that do not afford unborn children the right to life and place the woman's right to privacy above the right to life. But in the meantime, these decisions do leave some room for states to put common sense restrictions in place. What are some examples, for instance, of measures states can take to foster a culture of life, Rita?
Well, some examples of state laws that are already in place would include waiting periods on the woman who comes in and wants to have an abortion and oftentimes is very emotional and upset. Some state laws impose a waiting period to give her time to really think about what it is she's about to
do. Ordinarily, I think it's 24 hours. Yep. Some states have gone to 48 hours.
Exactly. Then there's parental consent. You know, when you have a minor in particular who's coming in seeking abortion, a lot of states require that the parents be notified and have an opportunity to be involved in the decision. I think that's critical. And then there's just informed consent, laws that do their best to try to make sure the woman is fully informed of what is happening in an abortion procedure and the risks of having that procedure. You know, we can't lose sight of the fact that these clinics that do abortions, they are making a profit. You know, they are profiting from this procedure. They have an interest in having the woman go through with the abortion. So the states need to make sure that that is balanced by a requirement of full informed consent.
Well, now we want to bring in a special guest to discuss a couple of measures that will be considered in the General Assembly this year.
On the phone with us today, we have Olivia Gans-Turner from National Right to Life and Virginia Society for Human Life. And I'm so glad she could join us today because Olivia really has a pulse on what is going on as far as legislation to foster a culture of life, both nationally and in Virginia. So, Olivia, welcome to the program.
Hello, Rita. Hello, Dean. Hello, Pastor. Everybody over there. Great to be with you.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could first just tell us a little bit about your position and the two organizations you represent.
Very well, Rita. I am the president of the Virginia Society for Human Life, which is the state affiliate of the National Right to Life Committee. So National Right to Life is, if you will, our parent organization. And both organizations are dedicated to working as hard as we can to pass the strongest legislation possible at the federal and the state level to protect all innocent human life. That includes, of course, the unborn children that we're trying to protect with our laws, but also other vulnerable people in America today. With Obamacare looming constantly, medical health care rationing is a direct attack on those with disabilities, the dependent elderly, and other classes of human beings who would otherwise find themselves in jeopardy under the law right now. So that's always been our focus, and it remains our focus now.
Well, we are so grateful for those two organizations and for you specifically, Olivia. Thank you so much for your commitment to life and the great work that you do. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about specific legislation pending in the Virginia General Assembly this year. Most of our audience is in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So what are the pieces of legislation that they should be looking for and supporting if they want to help foster a culture of life?
So this is a great opportunity to talk about these things. I can't thank you folks enough. There are two bills that we know are significantly possibly going to impact the nature of things in the debate in the Virginia General Assembly this year. The first is a bill that Virginia Society for Human Life is the primary patron of and organizer of. It's one we've introduced before. Some may have heard of the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. There is also a federal version of the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act that has already passed in the House of Representatives at Congress. we have never been able to get this bill to move very far forward in the Virginia General Assembly, although 12 other states, including West Virginia, right next door for any of your listeners who are there, 12 other states have already passed state versions of this bill. Mm-hmm. And we would very much like to see this bill start to move forward in the General Assembly. Now, we know we have a big obstacle ahead of us. HB 963 is the number of the bill. HB 963 is the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. And that bill faces serious opposition in the governor's mansion because we know Terry McAuliffe is a hardcore pro-abortion advocate and would probably veto this bill. But the goal of this legislation across the country as it's been moving forward is to bring very strong contrast in the conversation on the reality of the humanity of the unborn. Most people are unfamiliar with the fact that babies can feel pain in the womb. We know definitively as early as 20 weeks. So this bill would prevent abortion in the Commonwealth of Virginia after the point in pregnancy when the baby is capable of feeling pain. Now, right now, science tells us that's at 20 weeks. But science is moving so quickly, many physicians who do surgery on babies in the womb believe that that marker will move quickly back down to maybe as young as 15 weeks. Because they see the babies recoiling in pain when they do surgery on these kids. Yeah. So we would like to see this bill go forward for a proper debate and really start having this conversation in Virginia. So that's bill number one. And again, that's HB 963, and people should call their delegate and senator to ask them to please co-patron or support that bill. The second bill that is very important, we believe, in the current climate in the country at large, is what we're calling a priority funding bill. It's HB 1090. HB 1090 is sponsored by Delegate Klein. The previous bill is patroned by Delegate Dave LaRocque from the Loudoun County area, and Delegate Ben Klein, who's down there in the Valley in the Lexington area.
Yep, he's one of our Valley guys.
And we love what both men are doing, but Delegate Ben Klein's 1090, HB 1090, would require that all funding, all state funding, that's your tax dollars, your state tax money, all state funding that goes to provide services for women's health care would have to go to qualified and quantitative healthcare programs that provide complete health care, and that no organization or agency that promotes or provides abortions would be eligible for this state funding because most of those agencies do not provide the full range of women's health care, i.e. blood pressure screening or mammograms or issues concerning geriatric care for older women. They simply don't do that. They only do abortions. Yeah. This is an effort by Delegate Klein with HB 1090, the priority bill, to take the last remaining dollars away from such organizations, and we think it's a very, very positive thing to do.
So it sounds like, Olivia, the goal of that is to make sure that state funding that is supposed to be going to actual women's health care that women actually need to help them be healthy and well, does not end up actually being diverted to go to centers that pretty much just do abortions. Is that it?
That is correct. I mean, the reality is that we've all heard a lot this summer about the horrifying, nightmarish videos coming out of Planned Parenthood. But the reality is Planned Parenthood is not the only agency that actually operates in this way and uses the baby's bodies as if they're some kind of commodity. So this bill, HB 1090, would actually prevent monies from going to other abortion providers, like in Virginia, the American Women's Services, which is run by a nefarious abortionist out of the Virginia Beach area. His agencies would also be prevented from receiving monies, which actually just further their ability to have access to these babies' bodies that they're then selling and trading in the marketplace. Yeah. So this is an effort to recognize that there is legitimate health care available in Virginia, and those agencies that do legitimate full-range health care properly accessible to all Virginia women should be provided for first, and that no abortion facility should qualify. So it's really a positive step. Both of these bills are considered reasonable and common sense by the majority of Americans. They don't understand why their tax dollars are being used in any way to pay for abortion. They don't like that when it comes to the funding bill, the priority bill. And, of course, when it comes to the issue of pain, you and I both know that life should be protected from conception. Yes. But, unfortunately, We live in a society where many Americans don't understand the humanity of the unborn child from that point in time. Mm-hmm. So this is an opportunity to get the conversation to focus again on this baby who can feel pain just like you and I do. And so this it registers deeply with folks that this is a fellow human being who feels horrific pain during the process of abortion, and we can save them from that pain. And as you have that conversation, you're not just banning close to 1,000 abortions a year in Virginia, which is approximately how many abortions are done after the 6th month of pregnancy, but you're also making folks remember that this is someone we're talking about in this decision, not something. Yes. And that's, we think, a very, very high priority within the law, to remember that under the law, these human beings have a right to be protected.
Yes. Thank you so much, Olivia, for joining us today. And if folks want to find out more information about these two bills, is there a website you can refer them to?
Yes, I would encourage them to sign the petition for the pain-capable bill at www.vshl.org is our website. www.vshlpetition.org takes them directly to the petition, but they'll also find updates and notices about what will be going on with both of these bills and other bills that may tag on to these pro-life questions as the session goes forward. So I appreciate folks taking a look.
All right. Thank you so much, Olivia. God bless you this session in your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to being with you again with Victory News.
All right.
Thanks, Olivia. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So one of the other state pieces of legislation that we've had a lot of exposure to here in Virginia, Dean and Doc, has to do with abortion clinic safety regulations. And Dean, I know you were very much aware of this big fight that just recently happened in Virginia.
Well, Rita, I might say, too, that in the Commonwealth of Virginia, like other states, we have had to fight hard to get these common sense measures approved. Right now, by the way, Virginia ranks number 19 in America for pro-life legislation. It was higher. It was number 10 just within the past 5 years. But because we've had to fight against very strong opposition with a Democratic governor, a Democratic attorney general, it's been a struggle. But you talked about clinic safety. It was in 2011 that our General Assembly passed, after a bitter struggle, a bill that would improve the health, safety, and reporting requirements on all clinics that perform abortions so that the women who go there would receive better treatment, more quality treatment. Even though we were able to pass that bill in 2011, the Democratic members of the House of Delegates and of the Senate and our governor and attorney general are trying to undermine those efforts as we speak and trying to remove those protections aimed at providing better care for the women clients.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a good point for me to mention that the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up a new abortion case, the first it will have heard since 2007. Mm. The case is called Whole Women's Health versus Cole, and it deals with a law that sets clinic health and safety standards, just like the ones you were talking about, Dean. The law also requires abortionists to have hospital admitting privileges in case one of the procedures goes wrong and the woman needs to go to hospital. Now, if this Texas law is upheld that creates these clinic health and safety standards, reports are that Texas would go from having 40 abortion clinics operating in the state to having only 10. And so isn't that interesting? And I just have to say that I think it's such a bogus rationale that the other side of this issue often makes to say, well, if the result would be that clinics would have to shut down, this is not a good law. And it, you know, it must be an infringement on the woman's right to have an abortion. Well, I just don't get that.
We could go on. This is such an important topic and there's so much to cover, but our time is closed for today. Thank you, Rita and Dean, for sharing your expertise in the law and public policy. I'm sure Crossroads listeners are now better informed and motivated to take action. I know I certainly am. Crossroads had an encouraging year-end financially. Many of you responded with one-time gifts, and we picked up another business sponsor, Blue Ridge Chimney Services, to join our first sponsor, the dental offices of Scott Dunaway. We are so grateful to these business sponsors and to you, our faithful listeners. Your generosity keeps us on the air, so please send your contributions to Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia, 22803. Till next week, this is John Sloop for Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty, encouraging you to be salt and light and to make a difference for Christ at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.